Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, the capital asset pricing model. This is the second of the two lectures on risk and return. This one is actually a fairly short lecture, considering some of your lectures have been pretty long. This one is introducing you to the mathematical version of the risk-return relationship, and then I will show you how this actually plays out in some pretty dramatic real charts. And then from there, I will, there was one other thing. And then I'll introduce you to a spreadsheet so that you don't need to do the calculation of the capital asset pricing model. You can just put in the raw numbers. It's a real simple one, and you already have up in your class notes, your spreadsheets, you have the bond pricing enhanced, and also you have on the second tab how to a spreadsheet for doing clean and finding the dirty price from the clean price. So you've got those nice resources. And in your class spreadsheets, in file spreadsheets, class spreadsheets, I put up that one that I did with the discrete distribution of the economy and the GDP and all that. I've put that in up there in your class spreadsheet so that you can go back through that and see how that works, the mechanics of that. Now, next week, I will, on Wednesday, have a quiz for you. I'm playing for it to be a surprise, as all of my quizzes are unannounced. So it will be on Wednesday. That was not an announcement of the quiz. And it will be on bonds and risk and return primarily. So prepare for that one. And make sure that you're comfortable with the spreadsheet. Now, I have released the correct answers for the midterm. I had to wait quite a while for that, for a few excused absences, but that's available for you too to study for the final exam. What else? Oh, again, one more time, the Excel assignment is due on the 30th, so that's. You have 12 days left to get that Excel assignment done. You've had 77 days since the beginning of the semester, so now you're down to the last 12 to get it accomplished. If you're still having problems getting your certificate and all of that, just stop by our office. Now, tomorrow and Friday, there will be no office hours. I'm having a surgery, so the office will be closed. But you can send me email if you have questions, by all means, and I'll be back, I think, on Monday, unless something goes really wrong. But even if I die, I will be back on Monday. So don't celebrate too quickly if you see my obituary in the paper. Now, I look at the numbers, and the numbers are dark. As I told you, you saw on Monday, we did have a day that was a bullish day. But as I had told you, that was probably a dead cat bounce. Yep, the dead cat is back on the ground, heading for the graveyard. We have all of the numbers on our side of the world are down, and I'll talk more about what the political and the geopolitical economic dynamics are. But first of all, on the other side of the world, as you can see, the major indices like Tokyo and the Nikkei 225 looking good, nice, upward movement in it. There were some concerns that the regional war in the Middle East was going to start to engulf other countries, and most other countries have just said, no, we're not going to participate. We're just going to be cool about that. You have fun over there. And so that was favorably taken by the markets so they could keep going up. So you see Nikkei is up, Hong Kong's up, Australia, it kind of had a bad start to the day, but then they climbed back up somewhat, as you can see there with Australia down here. But over on the other in Europe, a kind of a mixed bag. It started out positive on in Europe and in Great Britain, but then it kind of lost its momentum and finished off a little bit. Nothing major on it, but it was just not a, there wasn't any real excitement in the day, a little bit of negative, especially in Great Britain. They're worried over there about the price of oil globally. And I'll get to that here in a minute, talk about what's going on with that. But now over here in our side, as you can see, we definitely have a bear day. The markets in general dropped right off the bat, as you can see from these spark charts. And then they dropped down, and then they just sort of slowed down and sort of just barely sliding more down through the day. The Dow right now is down not quite a 1%. And the S&P 500 is down about 0.2%. And the NASDAQ is down about 0.2%. So it's kind of a uniform, it's dark and it's negative. And there's some real crises hiding in the shadows. It would be really hard to explain, even start to explain to an average person. And, but I will explain it to you, at least in, not in huge detail, but there are some real, real concerning, things sitting in the sidelines that might make it really a bad, bear market. But we'll see if they actually come to the surface anytime soon. You come over here, and as you can see, gold is still down because a lot of banks are liquidating their gold reserves and trusts and all that. They're just gathering cash. They're just getting out of anything but cash, selling their gold, which will put the price of gold down, selling their silver, put the price of silver down, even selling their platinum. So they're getting out of the metals just so they can gather cash to hold, because that's basically a super safe harbor in holding the cash, although inflation can erode even that safe harbor. Now, if you look at the crude, we are definitely in the hundreds on Brent, and we're pushing toward about 70, 98 on overall crude, just because the supply of crude has been pinched quite significantly. Now, some countries are going to suffer more from that than other countries. An example of that is Great Britain. They are highly dependent upon foreign imports of oil. Even though they do extract oil from the North Sea, it's just not all that much. Interestingly, the United States, the Strait of Hormuz is where the problem is. The Iranians have pretty much blocked it off. The only way that a tanker, a shipment of gold can get through it is if it pays the transit fees in Chinese currency called the yuan, Y-U-A-N, yuan. They, if it's paid in petrodollars, they're not going to let it through. Now, to give you the numbers, first of all, 20 to 25% of the oil, world's oil supply does go through the Strait of Hormuz. Second, the strait is not actually completely closed. In terms of movement through the strait, we call the oil that's getting through dark transit oil, dark transit oil. It's oil that is allowed to go through because everything is being paid in Chinese currency. So the dark transit, if I'm looking at the numbers right from what's called Platts, which keeps track of everything on the high seas that's moving, it looks like there were about 90 dark transits in the last 48 hours, if I'm reading the numbers right. And then there were a few white transits, and they were all dropped. They were all sunk or set on fire. So, in other words, there is oil getting out of there. There's also oil coming out of Russia because we're turning a blind eye to Russia getting oil out into the market. Specifically, they're moving oil to India. So, in other words, there are leaks in the embargo, in the blockade, but that's not enough to keep a lot of oil on the high seas and getting to the refineries. So we are suffering from that. Now, the next thing is that we don't get a lot of our oil from places like Saudi Arabia, hardly any. So why is the price of oil we're paying so much? Simply because oil is a global commodity. It's not going to decide which country it is going to. It is priced based upon world demand and world supply. So yeah, it's going up in price. We probably, I don't know if we're going to see a whole lot more than 110 on Brent and 104 to 105 on average crude. But it will still go up. As you can see, the price of gasoline is already now hitting $3.99 a gallon, as I told you it would. It will probably make it up somewhat higher than that, maybe $4.39 over the next 2 to 3 weeks. It's all dependent upon whether this keeps getting worse and worse, as it seems to be getting right now. However, that doesn't mean it's inevitable that it's going to get worse. Cooler heads could prevail somewhere along here. However, the outlook for American companies, looking at the sector map, as you can see, it is pretty red. A few green spots, but overall, the sector map is indicating that we're seeing a bear market. And it's not just a light red, it's a pretty dark red. So if you look at some of those high tech companies that were the love children of Wall Street, as you look at them now, it's not a pretty picture. Let me see if I can get something like NVIDIA, NVDA, to show up. NVIDIA has actually done a pretty decent job. It rallied right here. It was dropping off this morning. And then there was something of a rally here, and it's just kind of bouncing around right now. So that's kind of a bright spot. Looking at some of the other ones like Apple, AAPL, Apple is down, taking a real bad hit today, already over 1.25% down. So that one's on the negative side. And then I could show you a few more of the big high-tech companies. But the message is that it's generally a bear market right now for the high-techs. Another industry that is going to be getting hit really hard over the next whatever is the agriculture industry, because we were heavily dependent upon Canada for some of the products that we use in agriculture, specifically something called potash, which is crucial to put on almost every field in the United States. We don't produce potash. We get it from Canada, and Canada has gotten pissed off enough at us that they've said, no, we're not going to just give you all those discounts we always did all those decades. If you want it, you're going to pay a hell of a tariff on it to get it from us. So if we looked at the ag sector, I'm thinking one of them might be ConAgra, but it might have actually made a good showing today, but I don't think so. ConAgra, CAG. I couldn't remember that trading symbol for the life of me. Oh gosh, that one's down a lot. ConAgra is down 3.33% today. That's giant. That's not just big ag. That's a giant ag. And as you can see, the market is very much punishing because companies like that are in severe trouble right now, because the products that they put on the fields are not going to go onto the fields. That means that crop yields this year could be really bad. One of the first years in memory that we might have crop yields below the year before, as really low below the year before, because without those critical products put on the field, ag products put on the fields, the yields will just go back to the way they were in the 1950s, 1960s. So that's where we are. Now, another mention, Canada doesn't provide us just with potash. It provided us with oil, provided us with electricity. It provided us with products like lithium. Now, if you know about lithium is what goes into these fancy batteries that power electric cars. So without those inputs, or with those inputs at extremely high prices with tariffs that Canada is already putting on us, those kinds of vehicles and the companies that build those kinds of vehicles are going to be in serious trouble. over the foreseeable future. So if you're looking for places not to invest or to invest in a bearish way, you want to stay away from these. And a little later in the course, by the way, I will show you how to make money in a bear market. You can't, one way you can make money, everyone thinks you make money by stock prices going up. Actually, you can make money by stock prices going down too. It's called short selling stocks. And it's not that complicated. It's a little trickier to do it, but you can make money off prices of stocks going into the toilet, just the same as you can if stock prices go up. So there are ways to get through this and to even profit from it. And I'll show you some of those in the weeks ahead. But on to the lecture of the day. Now over here, and I'll show you this now, and then I'll show you how to use it later. You go over here to your files, and you click on your spreadsheets, and you're going to see a spreadsheet near the top, CAPM, CAPM. CAPM stands for the Capital Asset Pricing Model. And you can download that if you want to now, just so you have it. And just as a quick, just to convince you that this simplifies calculating something, and it's actually so simple. Whoops, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Let's try expanding it. That's all there is to the spreadsheet, is that right there. Just three numbers you put in, and you can get the answers that you would need for something like a quiz or an exam. And I'll get to the capital asset pricing model here in a little while. It's sort of the culmination. If you will give me just a minute here, I also want to see if I can pull up something else. I'll have to come out of student view to do this one, to find it. But I've got something else that I want to show you. If I can find it here in at the top end of this, I will bring up real quick here, class. Where is it? Bear with me. If I can find it, I will show you this as a demonstration. I'm looking for the spreadsheet that shows the Dow, the Standard & Poor's, and the NASDAQ, all their returns very quickly. And maybe find it if I can. Ratios, sample problems, sign-in spreadsheets. I was hoping that I would find it here, but I may not be able to for today's lecture, but I can put it up. If I go to spreadsheets, maybe I put it in spreadsheets. I don't know if I did or not. Class spreadsheets, maybe I did it there. Colgate-Palmolive, beta, calculation, PE ratio, portfolio visualizer probabilities. Nope, not there. So I will have to go and bring it up. Maybe I'll show it tomorrow, but it's, if you would go through there, maybe you can see it. The risk-return relationship. The thing is that if I look just at standard deviation of return, that is overstating the risk of a stock. If you held a stock, one stock on its own, this would be the risk of that stock, sigma, that little formula that I did there. However, that is ignoring that risk has parts to it. There are two parts to the risk of a stock. But I want to start out with something called standalone risk. This, by the way, is more of a term. You would not have seen this term in books that even 10 years ago. It's sort of a more modern way of explaining the biggest type of risk. A company, the standalone risk is all of the risk of a specific stock. It's all of the risk that is inherent to a stock. Now, there's also something else that the book barely mentions. There is a something called company risk. The company risk is sort of internal to that company. It's specific to that company itself. Now, you could have two companies that are in the same industry, but they could have different company risks. One could be an old established company. It doesn't take crazy projects. It has very stable management. Its corporate governance is very tight. But you could have another company in the same industry, which is younger. It's more of a risk taker. It has a kind of management that you might not want to see in an old established company and all of that. So that company could have a very different risk profile than the other company. And then there is this risk called market risk. This is a special kind of risk. This is the risk of a company stock, its returns, in, how shall I put it, in the global picture. Market risk is that risk that I'm showing you as beta. Now let me tell you something about this. I'm trying to think. You, sir, look like a crazy man. You're out of you're wild. Matter of fact, you're a serial killer. I saw you kill some Frosted Flakes last week. Get it, cereal. Never mind. The hell with you. Okay. Now, on your own, you go out at night and you do the deed. Okay. That's him on his own. Now, you go to a party. It's a great party. You're having a good time. In that party, you aren't going to be a serial killer. You're going to blow the party vibe, you know? You see, in a larger environment, your risk profile suppresses. It's still there, that all that risk, but in a larger context, that risk begins to diminish. What I'm talking about here is something that is across all of the universe, in fact. We know that risk diminishes for any given component as the number of components in the system increases. So, for example, I'm going to show you your life, and I'm going to show you your life. Now, in the young man's life, this gentleman's life, I'm going to measure healthcare costs against time. Now, you started out your life as a sickly child. You came out and you had influenza, and it got worse. The diapers were pretty naughty, nasty. You got a little better, but all the time you had these very high healthcare costs. And you're 8, 9 preteen years, you had all kinds of little accidents. And then in your teen years, you found out about girls and then drugs. And then you got into your 20s, you calmed down a bit, but you got into your 30s, late 30s, high cholesterol, early 40s, diabetes. Now, I'm not saying And then you had your first heart attack. And then you had to start buying that ED medicine. be quiet. And then at the end, you live until about 70, and you're, you know, you have to wear Depends, and then thank God you die. You, being a girl, you started out lower healthcare costs. You were just a blessing, really nice, good girl. You had a few bumps and scratches as you were growing, and then your teen years, you had a few incidents. But you got into your 20s, and then your 30s. Well, in your 30s, you know, you started, you know, you had to join a weight loss program, and then you had a few incidents. You got some other ones here, but you were always kind of having problems. Of course, as you got older, you got more problems, but you lived longer, and then you die. Now, this is something called risk pooling. What happens is that these two graphs are not perfectly correlated. So they help to kind of cancel each other out a little bit. Now imagine over hundreds of thousands, millions of people, each having its own noise profile, and also adding more to this profile with new generations coming in. What happens is that over enough people, all that noise of the individual components turns into a hum that is easily predictable from year to year for a health insurer. Some people are getting sick while some people are well. Some people are well when others are sick. But what happens is that they cancel each other's noise out. And what emerges is a quiet, as I said, hum. We see this all through the universe. In fact, the air in this room, if you looked at an individual atom of oxygen, actually it's a pair of atoms, they are insane, they go crazy, they're flying all over the place. But in this room, they contain one another so that we don't feel any whooshes back and forth. That is the power of this calming agency that happens. I can even tell you about it in art. Some of my works are Impressionist art. I took a group of kids some years back to a display of Impressionist art in St. Louis at the gallery there. And this one girl was looking up right close to this Impressionistic painting by Monet. And I said, "It's pretty messy, isn't it?" And she said, "You know, it's just a mess." And I said, "Step back. If you step back far enough, it becomes a very, very identifiable, pretty work of art." The same thing happens in the universe. We see these beautiful galaxies and these quiet stars twinkling. They are actually total chaos inside. But put enough of them together and you actually get this same risk pooling effect. All through the universe, we have this happening. And that's why in stocks, we have the same thing happen. When you are buying stocks, you buy one stock, you're exposed only to the standalone risk of that company. All of its ups and downs, its managerial mistakes, its supply bottlenecks and all that kind of stuff. But if you start to put it together with other stocks, they tend to start canceling out each other's risk. In fact, I'm going to show you a website where you can look at how well they cancel each other's risk out. But the reality of it is that if I were to look, and there have been, you can even Google for this risk, this kind of thing. If I were to look at the number of stocks on the x-axis, And on the y-axis, I was looking at the total standard deviation of the portfolio. With one stock, you get all of the standalone risk of that stock. That's all there is. But as you start to add stocks to it, you will see, actually measuring the standard deviation, you will see that line sliding downward. It will run asymptotically toward market risk. You put enough stocks in a portfolio, you have taken away all of the peculiar risk of each of the stocks, and so they begin to show that underlying hum of the risk of the market itself. How many stocks does it take? Most studies, if you're doing a good portfolio diversification, at about 30, 35 stocks, depending upon what you choose, you get rid of about 95% of the non-market risk. Now, that's a lot of stocks. That's why professional investment analysts like me, we recommend that you use things like ETFs, where you're buying already pre-made portfolios. So all of that noise is out of there, and they keep it well balanced, because you do have to keep an eye on stocks. If one stock goes up too much in price, it begins to dominate the portfolio. And you really wouldn't want that to happen, because its risk begins to dominate the risk of the portfolio. So you have to keep adjusting the portfolio. But we can talk about that, and I will talk about that quite a bit a little later in the course. But one of the crucial, unbelievable. One of the crucial issues that you want to look for is how much two stocks run together as opposed to arguing with each other. In other words, you don't want stocks that do this together. You want stocks that kind of bounce against each other. In other words, you want low correlation coefficients. And there is actually a website, and I'm going to actually have to, let me take you over here. I'm going to put this one up, because this doesn't let me keep my bookmarks very well, so I'll have to go to Google to get the stock, the place again. Okay. Google.com. Yeah. And this is called the Portfolio Visualizer. Stock correlations. And I can't find it right now, but I actually have this site in a document in your files. Asset correlations. Portfolio visualizer. Here we go. You'll get the hang of this. Trust me, it makes all the sense in the world once you see it. I'm going to put in some stocks. Let me put in, for example, Kroger. I'll put in, let's take Ford. Let's take Facebook, which is Meta. Whoops. Meta, M-E-T-A. I don't know. I'll put in Ford. I didn't put in Ford. I deleted it accidentally. I don't know. Let me put in a stock like Pfizer, NVIDIA, and what else? Colgate-Palmolive, maybe. Colgate-Palmolive. And I like one more. Anyone got a random one off? Something kind of big. Let me do Lockheed Martin. Now, what'll come out is a correlation matrix. There it is. Now, it is symmetric to the diagonal. So, for example, Kroger against Meta has those two in a portfolio would have a correlation coefficient of 0.16. That's actually good. My own rule is nothing above 0.3. Above 0.3, they're behaving too much like each other. But at a correlation of only 0.16, these two are canceling out a lot of each other's diversifiable risk. Kroger against Ford, even lower. Kroger against Pfizer is still in there, NVIDIA. This is actually, if I'm looking at Kroger, Kroger is what we would call a good anchor stock because it doesn't correlate well with a lot of other stocks. Now, if I look at Meta against Ford is good, 0.23, against Pfizer's 0.14. Now, this one bothers me a little bit, and this one is kind of, well, I guess it, some of them, it's obvious why they have a high correlation, but this one, it's not as obvious. Correlation of Meta against NVIDIA is a little on the high side, 0.34. I guess in a way, you know, high tech or I don't know, but still, I would not probably want to put those in the same portfolio. And of course, again, Meta against Colgate-Palmolive, they really aren't anywhere in this near the same business. So you have a nice low correlation coefficient. And against Lockheed Martin, it has hardly any correlation. So Meta would be good in a portfolio as long as you avoided putting it with NVIDIA in the same portfolio, because they kind of don't help each other as much as other stocks would. This is a way, if you're starting out with one stock, you would probably want to try with one of those anchor stocks. And then from there, as you had some money, you might want to put it into another stock that had a low correlation with Kroger. You could be pretty confident that Kroger isn't correlating much with other stocks. Now, if I go to Ford against Pfizer, obviously low. Ford against NVIDIA, it's right on the borderline. But Ford against Colgate-Palmolive is good. Ford against Lockheed Martin is good. So Ford isn't a bad stock as far as portfolio diversification goes. Now I go down to Pfizer. Pfizer against NVIDIA is obviously, they're so different, the correlation coefficient is going to be low. But Pfizer against Colgate-Palmolive, they're both kind of in consumer goods, so you're going to see a little bit more of a correlation, which is undesirable. Now, this one I can't figure out. I've done this, and I put them together just so I can show that I got nothing. Pfizer against Lockheed Martin. One is a, you know, consumer drugs, medical stuff. Lockheed Martin is a war company. Why would they be correlated so much? I don't have an answer to you, and probably you could get someone who could explain some idea of why it happens, but I can't. I just would avoid those in the same portfolio. Now, going down here to Colgate-Palmolive, the last one, Colgate-Palmolive, yeah, against Lockheed Martin. Good grief, that's a high. Why that? Look at that. That's a very high correlation coefficient. You know, what the heck is going on there? It's kind of hard to tell. But anyway, this gives you an idea of how you, if you do want to custom build your own portfolio, this is how you would do it. The whole point here is that the market is not going to reward you for taking risk that you don't have to take. In other words, I'll give you an example. Microsoft, the volatility of returns to Microsoft stock, about 60% of that volatility is diversifiable risk. In other words, you could get rid of it by putting Microsoft into a portfolio. The market is not going to reward you for that wild ride of diversifiable risk, the risk that you could eliminate. The only reward you're going to expect is reward for non-diversifiable market risk. That's why beta is so important to us, is because it measures only portfolio risk. In other words, if I see a beta of 0.8, that doesn't mean that that stock's total risk is 0.8. That means the non-diversifiable part of it is 0.8. If you put that stock on, hold that stock on its own, that risk could be really bad. And you're going to get reward, you can expect a reward for only a small part of that risk. So what I'm saying here is that total risk has two pieces to it. Total risk has a part called non-diversifiable risk. We sometimes call this risk systematic risk. It is embedded in the system. And it has a diversifiable risk component. Sometimes we call this non-systematic. It's not in the system. It's on top of the system. You can cut it off. Let me try this. You, madam, you have cancer. But easy, easy. But you also have this ugly nodule on your nose. Yes, it's just a peachy scenario. Now, I can remove the nodule because it's not in the system. I can't remove the cancer because it is in the system. So in other words, we can't get rid of non-diversifiable risk. That's what you get rewarded for investing in. But I can get rid of the non-systematic risk. I can get rid of that because it's not in the system. I can just pull it off. So no market is ever going to reward you for what you could do on your own, get rid of that risk. That's why portfolio diversification, getting a portfolio, is so important. Buying single stocks is dangerous AF because those stocks can do wild, crazy things. Just like him. I have him on his own. He's out there. And you're an arsonist. You go out there on your own. You're torching everything. You torched your parents' house. You went down the street and you burned down the ice cream store. And then you were walking along and you saw this tree. Ah, darn you. Burn you down. But when I take you to a party, you're not going around. Well, you might be, but we'll throw you out if you do, or pour alcohol on you and watch you flame around screaming. But here's the thing, though, is you understand that whatever's going on in that party, that is the whole group doing things. You on your own, you're just a maniac. So are you. You're calm. You're nice and boring. But you see, that's the thing is, he is quiet, so he doesn't have a lot of non-systematic risk. But most of the time, stocks are going to be crazy wild. Those charts I show you with the stock price going up and down and up and down, that is those stocks on their own. You look at them when they're in a portfolio, and it would be a much calmer chart. We don't do that, though, because we don't know what portfolio you're putting together and all that. But here's the thing. watch out for this on a quiz, a little drop down testing you on whether you know, if to see if you know the difference between systematic and non-systematic risk, diversifiable and non-diversifiable, as it were, or non-diversifiable versus diversifiable. Okay, so this is the backdrop of what we have to look at if we want to know what a stock is going to return to us. Because we can't, we're going to make money by taking risk. You don't take risk, you don't make much money at all. So we have to recognize that risk is crucial to pricing a stock, but to getting the expected return to a stock. We fashioned this. It's called beta. Now, beta, as I have talked about, I like to introduce it before I tell you it's technical, because I want you to understand it on a common sense level before I show you a bunch of formulas. But this measure beta, the beta of a stock, here's how we find out, here's how we calculate it. We take the standard deviation of the stock, the stock's returns, in other words, up and down of the stock's return. And then we divide that by the standard deviation of the market itself, the entire market portfolio itself. And then we multiply it by the correlation coefficient between that stock and the market portfolio. That's how we do it. That's what those betas are. I've shown you those every time. That's how we calculate it. We get standard deviation of that stock's returns, and then we get the standard deviation of the world market itself, and then we multiply by the standard deviation, I'm sorry, the correlation coefficient of the two stocks. Those are the correlation coefficients over there. Okay, so let me show you something here. First of all, the beta of a risk-free security, like a treasury bill, is zero. It's exactly zero. The reason is this: the correlation of something that has no risk with anything else, including the market, is zero. So it just doesn't have a, so in other words, this zeroes out because there's no correlation of a riskless instrument with anything. It doesn't correlate with anything because it's just sitting there flat. Another one that we know is the beta of the market portfolio, because that would equal 1.0. Why? Because if this standard deviation on top is the market portfolio, then you would be taking sigma sub m over sigma sub m times the correlation of the market with itself, which obviously you get a 1. Now, let me show you some things here. Suppose that I wanted, okay, tell me a portfolio that would have exactly, oh, by the way, the market portfolio, we can't calculate every, the market portfolio would be a theoretical portfolio that has everything in the world in it. And so it is, to a certain extent, a theoretical animal. However, we do know that there are some portfolios of stocks that are really close to being the market. They have the huge companies of the world in them. And so they tend to be the market portfolio. Let me show you something here. Let me go back to finance.yahoo.com and get the markets. I'm going to put in here a portfolio that you could buy that is so close to the market portfolio that it has a beta of one. Watch. It's an ETF, and I've shown it to you before. The Spider, SPY. It has the 500 largest companies in the world in it, 500 of them. It is virtually, it's got so much of the market cap of the world in it that it behaves very close to the theoretical world portfolio. Just like, well, let me not get into that right now, but let me show you something. This is a massive world portfolio, portfolio of the 500 largest stocks in the country, in the world. If I look down here, let me find its, where the hell is its beta? I can't see. There it is. Look at that. It's got a perfect 1.00. That is basically the world portfolio. So if you want to invest in the entire world, you buy the Spider ETF. You don't buy thousands and thousands of stocks and try to build it yourself. You just use that one, and you've got it right there. So that's why when we need a sigma sub M, we just look at the S&P 500. That's all we do. So taking that one step further, I can show you a few more that, let me show you one more. Suppose this is a stock portfolio. Suppose that you don't like stocks. You'd rather have bonds. Well, if I want to look at bonds, there's one that is actually so close to the perfect that it's used as the benchmark for bonds. Any bond is measured against this one. AGG. It is essentially the world portfolio of bonds. And how do I know that? Look at its beta. Look how close to one it is. So actually, one good way you can invest is like put some of your money in Spider and put the rest of it in Ag. And you can, you know, like in good times, you 80% Spider, 20% AGG. And then in bad times, you know, you might flip it 25% in the Spider and 75% in the AGG. And that way you can move it back and forth. Good times, you move towards the stocks. Bad times, you move towards the bonds. And you can do as good as a professional investor just playing it this way. You don't have to worry about portfolio diversification because these are managed by professionals. They make their money if you make your money. And so they are constantly watching these their portfolio, rebalancing it and all that good stuff. That is responsible investing. Now, I admittedly, I have a fun account where I, you know, just take a position in a stock for a little while or in a derivative. And yeah, sure, we do that. But your main force of money probably is best managed by professionals, and all you have to do is buy shares of AGG and or SPY, and you've got all that portfolio diversification right there in these. Ouch. Oh, by the way, do your attendance radar right now while I set up this next thing for you. And now, for the capital asset pricing model. This is a formula that relates the beta of a portfolio to what you expect to make on it. Now, this isn't what you will make. This is the expected what you'll make on it. And it has a few moving parts to it. So, for example, this formula has the risk-free rate in it. Now, what we do for the risk-free rate, we usually look at like a one-year treasury bill. Well, what's the risk-free rate right now? Well, I'd go to that chart I showed you earlier and look for what the current yield is on a one-year treasury bill. The next one that I would look at that is one of the moving parts of this is the expected return to the market portfolio. What do we expect it to be right now? There are a couple of things, ways that we do this, but we need a number. So there are services out there that actually take a survey of a bunch of professionals in investment, in the Wall Street houses, in academia, and we say, we each give our estimate of what the one-year expected return to the market is, and they take an average of those. And you can go to one of the services. There are a lot of them out there. I participate in one of them. I'm a member of one of them. So this, you know, like right now, it was about 2 months ago, they did a survey in the one that I'm in, and they got a number for the expected return to the world market over the next year of, I think it was like 8.6%. There were other services that were a little higher, 9.2%. But you use one of those services, and that gives you an estimate for the expected return to the market portfolio. So here's how the capital asset pricing model works. It's actually a fairly simple formula, and I've made it even simpler for you with that Excel spreadsheet. So that what you're actually looking at here is the expected return to a stock or to a portfolio of stocks is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market minus the risk-free rate. That's the capital asset pricing model right there. That's CAPM. Now, sir, if you were thinking about, you know, getting a tattoo, you can't go wrong by getting that on your shoulder. No, seriously. What happens if you run into the finance gang down on Market Street? You show this to them and you'll be down with them. Actually, no, a trader's got this. Former student of mine. Weirdo. But anyway, let me tell you something here. See this guy right here, this R sub M minus R sub F? We call this, we have a name for this. This is called the market premium. Technically, the market premium over risk-free. In other words, this is what you expect the market to deliver you above and beyond what you would get if you just bought T-bills. You, madam, when you graduated from high school, you could have gone out and gotten a job. You would have made $15 an hour, and that would have been the end of it. But what did you do? You took the risk of going to college and ending up in a class with a big-nosed old fart for a professor in finance. Oh, of course you did. And so, but you were expecting to make more by doing that. This is what the same thing is doing here. It's saying, this is how much more you expect by taking risk, walking into that lion's den of the market instead of just investing in some safe government T-bills. That's what that is. And what, if you look at it, what beta is doing, it's showing you the magnification factor. Like if you got a beta of 1.2, that's saying that what's really going on is that you are taking a stock that magnifies the market premium by 120%. If you take buy a stock with a beta of 0.6, you're going to be taking a demagnification of the market premium down to 60%. That's all beta does. It just tells you the magnification or demagnification of that particular stock in the world, in the portfolio that you're making. Now, the risk-free rate here, any investment you make that has risk had better at least give you the risk-free rate. Why would you invest in something that didn't at least give you what a T-bill gives you? There would be no reason to. So R-sub-F is sort of like the substring. You better have at least that in your expected return on a stock. So what this does is, there's something called the security market line. And this is always shifting around. But it starts with a beta of 1.0 should give you the risk-free rate. And a beta of 1.0 should give you the expected return to the market. So in other words, the capital asset pricing model is actually just a straight line. You tell me a beta, I can tell you what the expected return to the stock is. A beta of 0.5 would be about there. A beta of 1.25 might be about there. That thing is called the securities market line. And it's plural, securities, because it's showing you every security can be mapped on this line. It's a gimme look. On a quiz or a final exam, I will just say, okay, what's the graph of the capital asset pricing model? It's the securities market line. Be careful, there's another line called the capital market line. Don't let me fool you with that. That's not it. This is the capital asset pricing model graphs as the securities market line. Just make sure you have that in your notes so you can nail it on the quiz. Okay. A little bit here, a little mention here. I'm going to draw this again, take out everything in it, and just sort of graph it here. Now, if the risk-free rate goes up, but your expected return to the market doesn't, this securities market line pivots that way. If the risk-free rate were to go up, but your expected return to the market portfolio stays the same, it would pivot this way. Similarly, if the risk-free rate goes down, it would pivot downward. It would stay anchored on that point. Now, what the inflation, if there's inflation, what it does is it just lifts the whole securities market line upward. That's the effect of inflation. Just a couple of mentions there of those. But here's something. This, we've done many, many tests of the CAPM. You know, we plot a bunch of stocks and a bunch of portfolios and get their betas, get their returns, and they all lie pretty darn close to this line. In other words, these scatter plots are actually kind of confirming that this is really what's going on. I would be remiss not to mention a couple of kinds of stock that behave off CAPM. For example, there's something called the small cap effect. Small companies that are traded seem to sit a little above it more than they should. There's another one called the January effect, where there's some stocks every January, they kind of park. We see these little, a few dots up in here. there are a lot of ideas about what's making this happen and why it keeps happening. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It's great for writing a master's thesis or a PhD diss. But there is something else I want to tell you about. Once in a while, we see a portfolio that is off the capital, the securities market line. We'll see it sitting up here. That is unusual. There's a randomness. Things can happen that are really unusual. But we do have a name for this. If we see a stock that has returns way too high for the capital, way too high, we say that difference between what it should be by CAPM and what it actually came out to be. We call that Jensen's alpha. We call it Jensen's alpha. Now, Jensen's alpha could be also negative, but we are always looking for a positive Jensen's alpha. As a matter of fact, one of the most respected websites in investing that I am a subscriber to, they've actually helped me, some of those people, they walked me through some really complex securities, and I appreciated that. It's called Seeking Alpha. If you want to ever look for it, just type Google, Seeking Alpha. They've got great information. Of course, it's all about finding things that have positive alphas. But here's another part of it, too. We are always trying to find investors who have persistence in positive alphas. We look for them. You get that portfolio free of charge. You can run, have a portfolio with us. We don't charge you for your trades, zero and all. You know what they're doing? They're looking over hundreds of thousands to millions of investors seeking alpha. Those one in a million investors who keep getting positive alphas. We want to know who they are so that we can start front running them. Once we figure out that someone just keeps getting positive alphas, as soon as that son of a bitch puts in an order, we're going to front run it and put it in our own order in front of him. That is why they give all these free accounts, is because they are trying to find those magicians. We don't know what's wrong with them, but they keep getting those positive alphas. It's the same thing that happens. For example, I took my students up to the White Sox one year just to get some internships, see if they'd get some internships. And they had this beneficial charitable organization up there. Every summer, they put out all hundreds and hundreds of Little League teams all through Chicagoland. And they did it on their own dime to keep these kids. And it was a great program to keep the kids off the streets, give them a sense of sportsmanship and all that. Well, you know what they were really doing? They were looking for that one kid in 1,000 in those leagues who just had a hand, had a swing, or had a pitch. One in 1,000, because they were able to see that, and then they could start working with that kid and his family to cultivate him. It's the same thing. We're always seeking the alpha in business. What has magic that shouldn't be there? In stocks, we're always seeking alphas, those who can't stop getting good, better returns than CAPM says they should. That's all I have for you today. Go home.